under the command of the Jacobin faction, led by Robespierre and Saint-Just, unleashed after the executions of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. It led to the executions of not only scores of aristocrats and counter-revolutionaries, but also several major figures of the revolution, including the former popular leaders Brissot, Danton, and Desmoulins. But the terror soon spun out of control and ultimately came to an end in July 1794 with the execution of its own leaders, including Robespierre and Saint-Just. There followed a phase of relative stability, first under the somewhat ineffective Directory between 1795 and 1799, and then with more concentrated power in the form of a three-person consulate, consisting of Ducos, Seyies, and Napoleon Bonaparte. Already during the Directory, the young general Napoleon Bonaparte had become famous for his military successes, and his influence was only to grow after 1799. The consulate soon became Napoleon's personal rule. He was initially elected first consul in November 1799, and then declared his emperorship in 1804 with the famous coup of the 18th Brumaire, the date in the new revolutionary calendar. The years between 1799 and the end of Napoleon's reign, 1815, witnessed a series of great military victories for France, including those at Austerlitz, Jena-Auerstadt, and Wagram, bringing continental Europe to its knees. They also allowed Napoleon to impose his will, his reforms, and his legal code across a wide swath of territory. But in many ways, the revolution had gone full circle, replacing the monarchy of Louis XVI with the dictatorship and then emperorship of Napoleon. The fall of Napoleon after his final defeat in 1815 would also bring a period of retrenchment, more restricted political rights, and the restoration of the empire under Napoleon's nephew, Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte. But all these were simply slowing the ultimate emergence of inclusive political institutions. The forces unleashed by the Revolution of 1789 ended French absolutism and would inevitably, even if slowly, lead to the emergence of inclusive institutions. France, and those parts of Europe where the revolutionary reforms had been exported, would thus take part in the industrialization process already underway in the 19th century. Exporting the Revolution. On the eve of the French Revolution in 1789, there were severe restrictions placed on Jews throughout Europe. In the German city of Frankfurt, for example, their lives were regulated by orders set out in a statute dating from the Middle Ages. There could be no more than 500 Jewish families in Frankfurt, and they all had to live in a small walled part of town, the Judengasse, the Jewish ghetto. They could not leave the ghetto at night, on Sundays, or during any Christian festival. The Judengasse was incredibly cramped. It was a quarter of a mile long, but no more than 12 feet wide, and in some places less than 10 feet wide. Jews lived under constant repression and regulation. Each year, at most, two new families could be admitted to the ghetto. And at most, 12 Jewish couples could get married, and only if they were both above the age of 25. Jews could not farm. They could also not trade in weapons, spices, wine, or grain. Until 1726, they had to wear specific markers, two concentric yellow rings for men and a striped veil for women. All Jews had to pay a special poll tax. As the French Revolution erupted, a successful young businessman, Meyer Amschel Rothschild, lived in the Frankfurt Judengasse. By the early 1780s, Rothschild had established himself as the leading dealer in coins, metals, and antiques in Frankfurt. But like all Jews in the city, he could not open a business outside the ghetto or even live outside it. This was all to change soon. In 1791, the French National Assembly emancipated French Jewry. The French armies were now also occupying the Rhineland and emancipating the Jews of Western Germany. In Frankfurt, their effect would be more abrupt and perhaps somewhat unintentional. In 1796, the French bombarded Frankfurt, demolishing half of the Judengasse in the process. Around 2,000 Jews were left homeless and had to move outside the ghetto. The Rothschilds were among them. Once outside the ghetto, and now freed from the myriad regulations barring them from entrepreneurship, they could seize new business opportunities. This included a contract to supply grain to the Austrian army, something they would previously not have been allowed to do. By the end of the decade, Rothschild was one of the richest Jews in Frankfurt and already a well-established businessman. Full emancipation had to wait until 1811. It was finally implemented by Karl von Dalberg, who had been made Grand Duke of Frankfurt in Napoleon's 1806 reorganization of Germany. Mayor Amschel told his son, "You are now a citizen." Such events did not end the struggle for Jewish emancipation, since there were subsequent reverses, particularly at the Congress of Vienna of 1815, which formed the post-Napoleonic political settlement. But there was no going back to the ghetto for the Rothschilds. Mayor Amschel and his sons would soon have the largest bank in 19th-century Europe, with branches in Frankfurt, London, Paris, Naples, and Vienna. This was not an isolated event. First, the French Revolutionary Armies, and then Napoleon, invaded large parts of continental Europe, and in almost all the areas they invaded, the existing institutions were remnants of medieval times, empowering kings, princes, and nobility, and restricting trade both in cities and the countryside. Serfdom and feudalism were much more important in many of these areas than in France itself. In Eastern Europe, including Prussia and the Hungarian part of Austria-Hungary, serfs were tied to the land. In the West, this strict form of serfdom had already vanished, but peasants owed to feudal lords various seigneurial fees, taxes, and labor obligations. For example, in the polity of Nassau-Usingen, peasants were subject to 230 different payments, dues, and services. Dues included one that had to be paid after an animal had been slaughtered, called the blood tithe. There was also a bee tithe and a wax tithe. If a piece of property was bought or sold, the lord was owed fees. The guilds regulating all kinds of economic activity in the cities were also typically stronger in these places than in France. In the western German cities of Cologne and Aachen, the adoption of spinning and weaving textile machines was blocked by guilds. Many cities, from Bern in Switzerland to Florence in Italy, were controlled by a few families. The leaders of the French Revolution, and subsequently Napoleon, exported the revolution to these lands, destroying absolutism, ending feudal land relations, abolishing guilds, and imposing equality before the law, the all-important notion of rule of law, which we will discuss in greater detail in the next chapter. The French Revolution thus prepared not only France, but much of the rest of Europe for inclusive institutions and the economic growth that these would spur. Some of the leaders of the French Revolution believed that the principles of equality before the law should be exported in all of Europe, and that all the absolutist monarchies and princely states should be brought down. But France was in chaos in the years following 1789, and in no state to actively intervene in the politics of other countries. As we have seen, however, alarmed by the developments in France, several European powers organized around Austria in 1792 to attack France, ostensibly to free King Louis XVI, but in reality to crush the French Revolution. The expectation was that the makeshift armies fielded by the Revolution would soon crumble, but after some early defeats, the armies of the new French Republic were victorious in an initially defensive war. There were serious organizational problems to overcome, but the French were ahead of other countries in a major innovation, mass conscription. Introduced in August 1793, mass conscription allowed the French to field large armies and develop a military advantage verging on supremacy even before Napoleon's famous military skills came on the scene. Initial military success encouraged the Republic's leadership to expand France's borders, with an eye toward creating an effective buffer between the new Republic and the hostile monarchs of Prussia and Austria. The French quickly seized the Austrian Netherlands and the United Provinces, essentially today's Netherlands. The French also gained effective control over much of modern-day Switzerland. In all three places, the French had strong control through the 1790s. Germany was initially hotly contested, but by 1795, the French had firm control over the Rhineland, the western part of Germany lying on the left bank of the Rhine River. The Prussians were forced to recognize this fact under the Treaty of Basel. Between 1795 and 1802, the French firmly held the Rhineland, but not any other part of Germany. In 1802, the Rhineland was officially incorporated into France. Italy remained the main seat of war in the second half of the 1790s, with the Austrians as the opponents. Savoy was annexed by France in 1792, and a stalemate was reached until Napoleon's invasion in April 1796. In his first major continental campaign by early 1797, Napoleon had conquered almost all northern Italy except for Venice, which was taken by the Austrians. The Treaty of Campo Formio, signed with the Austrians in October 1797, ended the War of the First Coalition and recognized a number of French-controlled republics in northern Italy. However, the French continued to expand their control over Italy even after this treaty, invading the Papal States and establishing the Roman Republic in March 1798. Piedmont was occupied in December 1798. In January 1799, Naples was conquered and the Parthenopean Republic created. With the exception of Venice, which remained Austrian, the French now controlled the entire Italian peninsula, either directly, as in the case of Savoy, or through satellite states such as the Cisalpine, Ligurian, Roman, and Parthenopean republics. There was further back and forth in the War of the Second Coalition, between 1798 and 1801, but this ended with the French essentially remaining in control. The French revolutionary armies quickly started carrying out a radical process of reform in the lands they'd conquered, abolishing the remaining vestiges of serfdom and feudal land relations, and imposing equality before the law. The clergy were stripped of their special status and power, and the guilds in urban areas were stamped out, or, at the very least, much weakened. This happened in the Austrian Netherlands immediately after the French invasion in 1795. And in the United Provinces, where the French founded the Batavian Republic with political institutions very similar to those in France. In Switzerland, the situation was similar, and the guilds as well as feudal landlords and the church were defeated, feudal privileges removed, and the guilds abolished and expropriated. What was started by the French revolutionary armies was continued, in one form or another, by Napoleon. Napoleon was first and foremost interested in establishing firm control over the territories he conquered. This sometimes involved cutting deals with local elites, or putting his family and associates in charge, as during his brief control of Spain and Poland. But Napoleon also had a genuine desire to continue and deepen the reforms of the revolution. Most important, he codified the Roman law and the ideas of equality before the law into a legal system that became known as the Code Napoleon. Napoleon saw this code as his greatest legacy and wished to impose it in every territory he controlled. Of course, the reforms imposed by the French Revolution and Napoleon were not irreversible. In some places, such as Hanover, Germany, the old elites were reinstated shortly after Napoleon's fall, and much of what the French achieved was lost for good. But in many other places, feudalism, the guilds, and the nobility were permanently destroyed or weakened. For instance, even after the French left, in many cases, the Code Napoleon remained in effect. All in all, French armies wrought much suffering in Europe, but they also radically changed the lay of the land. In much of Europe, gone were feudal relations, the power of the guilds, the absolutist control of monarchs and princes, the grip of the clergy on economic, social, and political power, and the foundation of Ancien Régime, which treated different people unequally based on their birth status. These changes created the type of inclusive economic institutions that would then allow industrialization to take root in these places. By the middle of the 19th century, industrialization was rapidly underway in almost all the places that the French controlled, whereas places such as Austria-Hungary and Russia, which the French did not conquer, or Poland and Spain, where French hold was temporary and limited, were still largely stagnant. Seeking modernity. In the autumn of 1867, Okubo Toshimichi, a leading courtier of the feudal Japanese Satsuma domain, traveled from the capital of Edo, now Tokyo, to the regional city of Yamaguchi. On October 14th, he met with leaders of the Choshu domain. He had a simple proposal. They would join forces, march their armies to Edo, and overthrow the shogun, the ruler of Japan. By this time, Okubo Toshimichi already had the leaders of the Tosa and Aki domains on board. Once the leaders of the powerful Choshu agreed, a secret Sacho alliance was formed. In 1868, Japan was an economically backward country that had been controlled since 1600 by the Tokugawa family, whose ruler had taken the title Shogun, commander, in 1603. The Japanese emperor was sidelined and assumed a purely ceremonial role. The Tokugawa shoguns were the dominant members of a class of feudal lords who ruled and taxed their own domains, among them those of Satsuma, ruled by the Shimazu family. These lords, along with their military retainers, the famous samurai, ran a society that was similar to that of medieval Europe, with strict occupational categories, restrictions on trade, and high rates of taxation on farmers. The shogun ruled from Edo, where he monopolized and controlled foreign trade and banned foreigners from the country. Political and economic institutions were extractive, and Japan was poor. But the domination of the shogun was not complete. Even as the Tokugawa family took over the country in 1600, they could not control everyone. In the south of the country, the Satsuma domain remained quite autonomous and was even allowed to trade independently with the outside world through the Ryukyu Islands. It was in the Satsuma capital of Kagoshima where Okubo Toshimichi was born in 1830. As the son of a samurai, he too became a samurai. His talent was spotted early on by Shimazu Nariakira, the lord of Satsuma, who quickly promoted him in the bureaucracy. At the time, Shimazu Nariakira had already formulated a plan to use Satsuma troops to overthrow the shogun. He wanted to expand trade with Asia and Europe, abolish the old feudal economic institutions, and construct a modern state in Japan. His nascent plan was cut short by his death in 1858. His successor, Shimazu Hisamitsu, was more circumspect, at least initially. Okubo Toshimichi had by now become more and more convinced that Japan needed to overthrow the feudal shogunate, and he eventually convinced Shimazu Hisamitsu. To rally support for their cause, they wrapped it in outrage over the sidelining of the emperor. The treaty Okubo Toshimichi had already signed with the Tosa domain asserted that a country does not have two monarchs, a home does not have two masters, government devolves to one ruler. But the real intention was not simply to restore the emperor to power, but to change the political and economic institutions completely. On the Tosa side, one of the treaty's signers was Sakamoto Ryuma. As Satsuma and Choshu mobilized their armies, Sakamoto Ryuma presented the shogun with an 8-point plan, urging him to resign to avoid civil war. The plan was radical, and though Clause 1 stated that political power of the country should be returned to the imperial court and all decrees issued by the court, it included far more than just the restoration of the emperor. Clauses 2, 3, 4, and 5 stated 2. Two legislative bodies, an upper and lower house, should be established, and all government measures should be decided on the basis of general opinion. 3. Men of ability among the lords, nobles, and people at large should be employed as counselors, and traditional offices of the past, which have lost their purpose, should be abolished. 4. Foreign affairs should be carried on according to appropriate regulations worked out on the basis of general opinion. 5. Legislation and regulations of earlier times should be set aside, and a new and adequate code should be selected. Shogun Yoshinobu agreed to resign, and on January 3, 1868, the Meiji Restoration was declared. Emperor Komei and, 1 month later, his son Meiji were restored to power. Though Satsuma and Choshu forces now occupied Edo and the imperial capital Kyoto, They feared that the Tokugawas would attempt to regain power and recreate the shogunate. Okubo Toshimichi wanted the Tokugawas crushed forever. He persuaded the emperor to abolish the Tokugawa domain and confiscate their lands. On January 27th, the former shogun, Yoshinobu, attacked Satsuma and Choshu forces, and civil war broke out. It raged until the summer, when finally the Tokugawas were vanquished. Following the Meiji Restoration, there was a process of transformative institutional reforms in Japan. In 1869, feudalism was abolished, and the 300 fiefs were surrendered to the government and turned into prefectures, under the control of an appointed governor. Taxation was centralized, and a modern bureaucratic state replaced the old feudal one. In 1869, the equality of all social classes before the law was introduced, and restrictions on internal migration and trade were abolished. The samurai class was abolished, though not without having to put down some rebellions. Individual property rights on land were introduced, and people were allowed freedom to enter and practice any trade. The state became heavily involved in the construction of infrastructure. In contrast to the attitudes of absolutist regimes to railways, in 1869, the Japanese regime formed a steamship line between Tokyo and Osaka and built the first railway between Tokyo and Yokohama. It also began to develop a manufacturing industry, and Okubo Toshimichi, as Minister of Finance, oversaw the beginning of a concerted effort of industrialization. The Lord of Satsuma Domain had been a leader in this, building factories for pottery, cannon, and cotton yarn, and importing English textile machinery to create the first modern cotton spinning mill in Japan in 1861. He also built two modern shipyards. By 1890, Japan was the first Asian country to adopt a written constitution, and it created a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament, the Diet, and an independent judiciary. These changes were decisive factors in enabling Japan to be the primary beneficiary from the Industrial Revolution in Asia. In the mid-19th century, both China and Japan were poor nations, languishing under absolutist regimes. The absolutist regime in China had been suspicious of change for centuries. Though there were many similarities between China and Japan, the Tokugawa shogunate had also banned overseas trade in the 17th century, as Chinese emperors had done earlier, and were opposed to economic and political change, there were also notable political differences. China was a centralized bureaucratic empire ruled by an absolute emperor. The emperor certainly faced constraints on his power, the most important of which was the threat of rebellion. During the period 1850 to 1864, the whole of southern China was ravaged by the Taiping Rebellion, in which millions died either in conflict or through mass starvation. But opposition to the emperor was not institutionalized. The structure of Japanese political institutions was different. The shogunate had sidelined the emperor, but as we have seen, the Tokugawa power was not absolute, and domains such as that of the Satsumas maintained independence, even the ability to conduct foreign trade on their own behalf. As with France, an important consequence of the British Industrial Revolution for China and Japan was military vulnerability. China was humbled by British sea power during the First Opium War between 1839 and 1842, and the same threat became all too real for the Japanese as U.S. warships, led by Commodore Matthew Perry, pulled into Edo Bay in 1853. The reality that economic backwardness created military backwardness was part of the impetus behind Shimazu Nariakira's plan to overthrow the shogunate and put in motion the changes that eventually led to the Meiji Restoration. The leaders of the Satsuma domain realized that economic growth, perhaps even Japanese survival, could be achieved only by institutional reforms. But the shogun opposed this because his power was tied to the existing set of institutions. To exact reforms, the shogun had to be overthrown, and he was. The situation was similar in China, but the different initial political institutions made it much harder to overthrow the emperor, something that happened only in 1911. Instead of reforming institutions, the Chinese tried to match the British militarily, by importing modern weapons. The Japanese built their own armaments industry. As a consequence of these initial differences, each country responded differently to the challenges of the 19th century, and Japan and China diverged dramatically in the face of the critical juncture created by the Industrial Revolution. While Japanese institutions were being transformed and the economy was embarking on a path of rapid growth, in China, forces pushing for institutional change were not strong enough, and extractive institutions persisted largely unabated until they would take a turn for the worse with Mao's Communist Revolution in 1949. Roots of World Inequality. This and the previous three chapters have told the story of how inclusive economic and political institutions emerged in England to make the Industrial Revolution possible, and why certain countries benefited from the Industrial Revolution and embarked on the path to growth, while others did not, or, in fact, steadfastly refused to allow even the beginning of industrialization. Whether a country did embark on industrialization was largely a function of its institutions. The United States, which underwent a transformation similar to the English Glorious Revolution, had already developed its own brand of inclusive political and economic institutions by the end of the 18th century. It would thus become the first nation to exploit the new technologies coming from the British Isles, and would soon surpass Britain and become the forerunner of industrialization and technological change. Australia followed a similar path to inclusive institutions, even if somewhat later and somewhat less noticed. Its citizens, just like those in England and the United States, had to fight to obtain inclusive institutions. Once these were in place, Australia would launch its own process of economic growth. Australia and the United States could industrialize and grow rapidly because their relatively inclusive institutions would not block new technologies, innovation, or creative destruction. Not so in most of the other European colonies. Their dynamics would be quite the opposite of those in Australia and the United States. Lack of a native population or resources to be extracted made colonialism in Australia and the United States a very different sort of affair, even if their citizens had to fight hard for their political rights and for inclusive institutions. In the Moluccas, as in the many other places Europeans colonized in Asia, in the Caribbean, and in South America, citizens had little chance of winning such a fight. In these places, European colonists imposed a new brand of extractive institutions, or took over whatever extractive institutions they found, in order to be able to extract valuable resources, ranging from spice and sugar to silver and gold. In many of these places, they put in motion a set of institutional changes that would make the emergence of inclusive institutions very unlikely. In some of them, they explicitly stamped out whatever burgeoning industry or inclusive economic institutions existed. Most of these places would be in no situation to benefit from industrialization in the 19th century, or even in the 20th. The dynamics in the rest of Europe were also quite different from those in Australia and the United States. As the Industrial Revolution in Britain was gathering speed at the end of the 18th century, most European countries were ruled by absolutist regimes, controlled by monarchs and by aristocracies, whose major source of income was from their land holdings or from trading privileges they enjoyed, thanks to prohibitive entry barriers. The creative destruction that would be wrought by the process of industrialization would erode the leaders' trading profits and take resources and labor away from their lands. The aristocracies would be economic losers from industrialization. More important, they would also be political losers, as the process of industrialization would undoubtedly create instability and political challenges to their monopoly of political power. But the institutional transitions in Britain and the Industrial Revolution created new opportunities and challenges for European states. Though there was absolutism in Western Europe, the region had also shared much of the institutional drift that had impacted Britain in the previous millennium. But the situation was very different in Eastern Europe, the Ottoman Empire, and China. These differences mattered for the dissemination of industrialization. Just like the Black Death or the rise of Atlantic trade, The critical juncture created by industrialization intensified the ever-present conflict over institutions in many European nations. A major factor was the French Revolution of 1789. The end of absolutism in France opened the way for inclusive institutions, and the French ultimately embarked on industrialization and rapid economic growth. The French Revolution, in fact, did more than that. It exported its institutions by invading and forcibly reforming the extractive institutions of several neighboring countries. It thus opened the way to industrialization, not only in France, but in Belgium, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and parts of Germany and Italy. Farther east, the reaction was similar to that after the Black Death, when, instead of crumbling, feudalism intensified. Austria-Hungary, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire fell even further behind economically, but their absolutist monarchies managed to stay in place until the First World War. Elsewhere in the world, absolutism was as resilient as in Eastern Europe. This was particularly true in China, where the Ming-Qing transition led to a state committed to building a stable agrarian society and hostile to international trade. But there were also institutional differences that mattered in Asia. If China reacted to the Industrial Revolution as Eastern Europe did, Japan reacted in the same way as Western Europe. Just as in France, it took a revolution to change the system, this time one led by the renegade lords of the Satsuma, Choshu, Tosa, and Aki domains. These lords overthrew the shogun, created the Meiji Restoration, and moved Japan onto the path of institutional reforms and economic growth. We also saw that absolutism was resilient in isolated Ethiopia. Elsewhere on the continent, the very same force of international trade that helped to transform English institutions in the 17th century locked large parts of Western and Central Africa into highly extractive institutions via the slave trade. This destroyed societies in some places and led to the creation of extractive slaving states in others. The institutional dynamics we have described ultimately determined which countries took advantage of the major opportunities present in the 19th century onward, and which ones failed to do so. The roots of the world inequality we observe today can be found in this divergence. With a few exceptions, the rich countries of today are those that embarked on the process of industrialization and technological change starting in the 19th century, and the poor ones are those that did not. Chapter 11. The Virtuous Circle. The Black Act. Windsor Castle, located just west of London, is one of the great royal residences of England. In the early 18th century, the castle was surrounded by a great forest full of deer, though little of this remains today. One of the keepers of the forest in 1722, Baptist Nunn, was locked into a violent conflict. On June 27th, he recorded, "Blacks came in the night, shot at me 3 times, 2 bullets into my chamber window, and I agreed to pay them 5 guineas at Crowthorne on the 30th. Another entry in Nunn's diary read, "A fresh surprise, one appeared disguised with a message of destruction." Who were these mysterious blacks making threats, shooting at Nunn and demanding money? The blacks were groups of local men who had their faces blacked to conceal their appearance at night. They appeared widely across southern England in this period, killing and maiming deer and other animals, burning down haystacks and barns, and destroying fences and fish ponds. On the surface, it was sheer lawlessness, but it wasn't. Illegal hunting, poaching, deer in the lands owned by the king or other members of the aristocracy had been going on for a long time. In the 1640s, during the Civil War, the entire population of deer at Windsor Castle was killed. After the Restoration in 1660, when Charles II came to the throne, the deer park was restocked. But the blacks were not just poaching deer to eat, they also engaged in wanton destruction. To what end? A crucial building block of the Glorious Revolution of 1688 was the pluralistic nature of interests represented in Parliament. None of the merchants, industrialists, gentry, or aristocracy allied with William of Orange and then with the Hanoverian monarchs, who succeeded Queen Anne in 1707, were strong enough to impose their will unilaterally. Attempts at restoring the Stuart monarchy continued throughout much of the 18th century. After James II's death in 1701, his son, James Francis Edward Stuart, the Old Pretender, was recognized as the lawful heir to the English crown by France, Spain, the Pope, and supporters of the Stuart monarchy in England and Scotland, the so-called Jacobites. In 1708, the Old Pretender attempted to take back the throne with support of French troops, but was unsuccessful. In the ensuing decades, there would be several Jacobite revolts, including major ones in 1715 and 1719. In 1745 through 46, the Old Pretender's son, Charles Edward Stuart, the Young Pretender, made an attempt to take back the throne, but his forces were defeated by the British Army. The Whig political party, which, as we saw, was founded in the 1670s to represent the new mercantile and economic interests, was the main organization behind the Glorious Revolution, and the Whigs dominated Parliament from 1714 to 1760. Once in power, they were tempted to use their newly found position to prey on the rights of others, to have their cake and eat it too. They were no different from the Stuart kings, but their power was far from absolute. It was constrained both by competing groups in Parliament, particularly the Tory party, which had formed to oppose the Whigs, and by the very institutions that they had fought to introduce to strengthen Parliament and to prevent the emergence of a new absolutism and the return of the Stuarts. The pluralistic nature of society that emerged from the Glorious Revolution also meant that the population at large, even those without formal representation in Parliament, had been empowered, and blacking was precisely a response by the common people to perceptions that the Whigs were exploiting their position. The case of William Cadogan, a successful general in the War of the Spanish Succession between 1701 and 1714, and in the suppression of the Jacobite revolts, illustrates the sort of encroachment of common people's rights by the Whigs that led to blacking. George I made Cadogan a baron in 1716, and then an earl in 1718. He was also an influential member of the Regency Council of Lords Justices, which presided over major affairs of state, and he served as the acting commander-in-chief. He bought a large property of about 1,000 acres at Caversham, about 20 miles west of Windsor. There he built a grand house and ornate gardens, and laid out a 240-acre deer park. Yet this property was consolidated by encroaching on the rights of those around the estate. People were evicted, and their traditional rights to graze animals and collect peat and firewood were abrogated. Cadogan faced the wrath of the blacks. On January 1, 1722, and again in July, the park was raided by mounted and armed blacks. The first attack killed 16 deer. Earl Cadogan was not alone. The estates of many notable landowners and politicians were also raided by the blacks. The Whig government was not going to take this lying down. In May 1723, Parliament passed the Black Act, which created an extraordinary 50 new offenses that were punishable by hanging. The Black Act made it a crime not only to carry weapons, but to have a blackened face. The law, in fact, was soon amended to make blacking punishable by hanging. The Whig elites went about implementing the law with gusto. Baptist Nunn set up a network of informers in Windsor Forest to discover the identity of the blacks. Soon several were arrested. The transition from arrest to hanging ought to have been a straightforward affair. After all, the Black Act had already been enacted. The Whigs were in charge of Parliament, Parliament was in charge of the country, and the blacks were acting directly contrary to the interests of some powerful Whigs. Even Sir Robert Walpole, Secretary of State, then Prime Minister, and, like Cadogan, another influential member of the Regency Council of the Lords Justices, was involved. He had a vested interest in Richmond Park in southwest London, which had been created out of common land by Charles I. This park also encroached upon the traditional rights of local residents to graze their animals, hunt hares and rabbits, and collect firewood. But the ending of these rights appears to have been rather laxly enforced, and grazing and hunting continued until Walpole arranged for his son to become the park ranger. At this time, the park was closed off, a new wall was constructed, and man-traps were installed. Walpole liked hunting deer, and he had a lodge built for himself at Houghton within the park. The animosity of local blacks was soon ignited. On November 10, 1724, a local resident outside the park, John Huntridge, was accused of aiding deer stealers and abetting known blacks, both crimes punishable by hanging. The prosecution of Huntridge came right from the top, initiated by the Regency Council of Lords Justices, which Walpole and Cadogan dominated. Walpole went so far as to extract evidence himself as to Huntridge's guilt from an informant, Richard Blackburn. Conviction ought to have been a foregone conclusion, but it wasn't. After a trial of 8 or 9 hours, the jury found Huntridge innocent, partly on procedural grounds, since there were irregularities with the way the evidence had been collected. Not all blacks, or those who sympathized with them, were as lucky as Huntridge. Though some others were also acquitted or had their convictions commuted, many were hanged or transported to the penal colony of choice at the time, North America. The law, in fact, stayed on the statute books until it was repealed in 1824. Yet Huntridge's victory is remarkable. The jury was made up not of Huntridge's peers, but of major landowners and gentry who ought to have sympathized with Walpole. But this was no longer the 17th century, where the Court of Star Chamber could simply follow the wishes of Stuart monarchs and act as an open tool of repression against their opponents, and where kings could remove judges whose decisions they did not like. Now the Whigs also had to abide by the rule of law, the principle that laws should not be applied selectively or arbitrarily, and that nobody is above the law. The events surrounding the Black Act would show that the Glorious Revolution had created the rule of law, and that this notion was stronger in England and Britain, and the elites far more constrained by it than they themselves imagined. Notably, the rule of law is not the same as rule by law. Even if the Whigs could pass a harsh, repressive law to quash obstacles from common people, they had to contend with additional constraints because of the rule of law. Their law violated the rights that the Glorious Revolution and the changes in political institutions that followed from it had already established for everybody, by tearing down the divine rights of kings and the privileges of elites. The rule of law then implied that both elites and non-elites alike would resist its implementation. The rule of law is a very strange concept when you think about it in historical perspective. Why should laws be applied equally to all? If the king and the aristocracy have political power and the rest don't, it's only natural that whatever is fair game for the king and the aristocracy should be banned and punishable for the rest. Indeed, the rule of law is not imaginable under absolutist political institutions. It is a creation of pluralist political institutions and of the broad coalitions that support such pluralism. It's only when many individuals and groups have a say in decisions and the political power to have a seat at the table, that the idea that they should all be treated fairly starts making sense. By the early 18th century, Britain was becoming sufficiently pluralistic, and the Whig elites would discover that, as enshrined in the notion of the rule of law, laws and institutions would constrain them too. But why did the Whigs and parliamentarians abide by such restraints? Why didn't they use their control over Parliament and the state to force an uncompromising implementation of the Black Act and overturn the courts when the decisions didn't go their way? The answer reveals much about the nature of the Glorious Revolution, why it didn't just replace an old absolutism with a new version, the link between pluralism and the rule of law, and the dynamics of virtuous circles. As we saw in Chapter 7, the Glorious Revolution was not the overthrow of one elite by another, but a revolution against absolutism by a broad coalition made up of the gentry, merchants, and manufacturers, as well as groupings of Whigs and Tories. The emergence of pluralist political institutions was a consequence of this revolution. The rule of law also emerged as a byproduct of this process. With many parties at the table sharing power, it was natural to have laws and constraints applied to all of them, lest one party start amassing too much power and ultimately undermine the very foundations of pluralism. Thus, the notion that there were limits and restraints on rulers, the essence of the rule of law, was part of the logic of pluralism. engendered by the broad coalition that made up the opposition to Stuart absolutism. In this light, it should be no surprise that the principle of the rule of law, coupled with the notion that monarchs did not have divine rights, was in fact a key argument against Stuart absolutism. As the British historian E.P. Thompson put it, in the struggle against the Stuart monarchs, immense efforts were made to project the image of a ruling class which was itself subject to the rule of law, and whose legitimacy rested upon the equity and universality of these legal forms. And the rulers were, in serious senses, whether willingly or unwillingly, the prisoners of their own rhetoric. They played games of power according to rules which suited them, but they could not break those rules, or the whole game would be thrown away. Throwing the game away would destabilize the system and open the way for absolutism by a subset of the broad coalition, or even risk the return of the Stuarts. In Thompson's words, what inhibited Parliament from creating a new absolutism was that, take away law and the royal prerogative might flood back upon their properties and lives. Moreover, it was inherent in the very nature of the medium which they, those aristocrats, merchants, etc., fighting the crown, had selected for their own self-defense, that it could not be reserved for the exclusive use only of their own class. The law, in its forms and traditions, entailed principles of equity and universality which had to be extended to all sorts and degrees of men. Once in place, the notion of the rule of law not only kept absolutism at bay, but also created a type of virtuous circle. If the laws applied equally to everybody, then no individual or group, not even Cadogan or Walpole, could rise above the law, and common people, accused of encroaching on private property, still had the right to a fair trial. We saw how inclusive economic and political institutions emerge, but why do they persist over time? The history of the Black Act and the limits to its implementation illustrate the virtuous circle, a powerful process of positive feedback that preserves these institutions in the face of attempts at undermining them, and, in fact, sets in motion forces that lead to greater inclusiveness. The logic of virtuous circles stems partly from the fact that inclusive institutions are based on constraints on the exercise of power and on a pluralistic distribution of political power in society, enshrined in the rule of law. The ability of a subset to impose its will on others without any constraints, even if those others are ordinary citizens, as Huntridge was, threatens this very balance. If it were temporarily suspended in the case of the peasants protesting against elites encroaching on their communal lands, what was there to guarantee that it would not be suspended again? And the next time it was suspended, what would prevent the crown and aristocracy from taking back what the merchants, businessmen, and the gentry had gained in the intervening half-century? In fact, the next time it was suspended, perhaps the entire project of pluralism would come crumbling down, because a narrow set of interests would take control at the expense of the broad coalition. The political system would not risk this. But this made pluralism, and the rule of law that it implied, persistent features of British political institutions. And we will see that once pluralism and the rule of law were established, there would be demand for even greater pluralism and greater participation in the political process. The virtuous circle arises not only from the inherent logic of pluralism and the rule of law, but also because inclusive political institutions tend to support inclusive economic institutions. This then leads to a more equal distribution of income, empowering a broad segment of society and making the political playing field even more level. This limits what one can achieve by usurping political power and reduces the incentives to recreate extractive political institutions. These factors were important in the emergence of truly democratic political institutions in Britain. Pluralism also creates a more open system and allows independent media to flourish, making it easier for groups that have an interest in the continuation of inclusive institutions to become aware and organize against threats to these institutions. It is highly significant that the English state stopped censoring the media after 1688. The media played a similarly important role in empowering the population at large and in the continuation of the virtuous circle of institutional development in the United States, as we will see in this chapter. While the virtuous circle creates a tendency for inclusive institutions to persist, it is neither inevitable nor irreversible. Both in Britain and the United States, inclusive economic and political institutions were subject to many challenges. In 1745, the Young Pretender got all the way to Derby, a mere 100 miles from London, with an army to unseat the political institutions forged during the Glorious Revolution. But he was defeated. More important than the challenges from without were potential challenges from within that might also have led to the unraveling of inclusive institutions. As we saw in the context of the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester in 1819, and as we will see in more detail next, British political elites thought of using repression to avoid having to further open the political system, but they pulled back from the brink. Similarly, inclusive economic and political institutions in the United States faced serious challenges, which could have conceivably succeeded, but didn't. And of course, it was not preordained that these challenges should be defeated. It is due to not only the virtuous circle, but also to the realization of the contingent path of history that British and U.S. inclusive institutions survived and became substantially stronger over time. The slow march of democracy. The response to the Black Act showed ordinary British people that they had more rights than they previously realized. They could defend their traditional rights and economic interests in the courts and in Parliament through the use of petitions and lobbying. But this pluralism had not yet delivered effective democracy. Most adult men could not vote, neither could women, and there were many inequities in the existing democratic structures. All this was to change. The virtuous circle of inclusive institutions not only preserves what has already been achieved, but also opens the door to greater inclusiveness. The odds were against the British elite of the 18th century maintaining their grip on political power without serious challenges. This elite had come to power by challenging the divine right of kings and opening the door to participation by the people in politics, but then they gave this right only to a small minority. It was only a matter of time until more and more of the population demanded the right to participate in the political process, and in the years leading up to 1831, they did. The first 3 decades of the 19th century witnessed increasing social unrest in Britain, mostly in response to increasing economic inequities and demands from the disenfranchised masses for greater political representation. The Luddite riots of 1811 to 1816, where workers fought against the introduction of new technologies they believed would reduce their wages, were followed by riots explicitly demanding political rights, the Spafields riots of 1816 in London and the Peterloo Massacre of 1819 in Manchester. In the Swing riots of 1830, agricultural workers protested against falling living standards, as well as the introduction of new technology. Meanwhile, in Paris, the July Revolution of 1830 exploded. A consensus among elites was starting to form that the discontent was reaching the boiling point, and the only way to diffuse social unrest and turn back a revolution was by meeting the demands of the masses and undertaking parliamentary reform. It was no surprise, then, that the 1831 election was mostly about a single issue, political reform. The Whigs, almost 100 years after Sir Robert Walpole, were much more responsive to the wishes of the common man and campaigned to extend voting rights. But this meant only a small increase in the electorate. Universal suffrage, even only for men, was not on the table. The Whigs won the election, and their leader, Earl Grey, became the Prime Minister. Earl Grey was no radical, far from it. He and the Whigs pushed for reform, not because they thought a broader voting franchise was more just or because they wanted to share power. British democracy was not given by the elite. It was largely taken by the masses, who were empowered by the political processes that had been ongoing in England and the rest of Britain for the last several centuries. They had become emboldened by the changes in the nature of political institutions unleashed by the Glorious Revolution. Reforms were granted because the elite thought that reform was the only way to secure the continuation of their rule, albeit in a somewhat lessened form. Earl Grey, in his famous speech to the Parliament in favor of political reform, said this very clearly. There is no one more decided against annual parliaments, universal suffrage, and the ballot than I am. My object is not to favor, but to put an end to such hopes and projects. The principle of my reform is to prevent the necessity of revolution, reforming to preserve and not to overthrow. The masses did not just want the vote for its own sake, but to have a seat at the table to be able to defend their interests. This was well understood by the Chartist movement, which led the campaign for universal suffrage after 1838, taking its name from its adoption of the People's Charter, named to evoke a parallel with the Magna Carta. Chartist J.R. Stevens articulated why universal suffrage and the vote for all citizens was key for the masses. The question of universal suffrage is a knife and fork question, a bread and cheese question. By universal suffrage, I mean to say that every working man in the land has a right to a good coat on his back, a good hat on his head, a good roof for the shelter of his household, a good dinner upon his table. Stevens had well understood that universal suffrage was the most durable way of empowering the British masses further and guaranteeing a coat, a hat, a roof, and a good dinner for the working man. Ultimately, Earl Grey was successful both in ensuring the passage of the first Reform Act and in diffusing the revolutionary tides without taking any major strides toward universal mass suffrage. The 1832 reforms were modest, only doubling the voting franchise from 8% to about 16% of the adult male population, from about 2 to 4% of all the population. They also got rid of rotten boroughs and gave independent representation to the new industrializing cities such as Manchester, Leeds, and Sheffield. But this still left many issues unresolved. Hence, there were soon further demands for greater voting rights and further social unrest. In response, further reform would follow. Why did the British elites give in to the demands? Why did Earl Grey feel that partial, indeed very partial, reform was the only way to preserve the system? Why did they have to put up with the lesser of the two evils, reform or revolution, rather than maintaining their power without any reform? Couldn't they have just done what the Spanish conquistadors did in South America, what Austria-Hungarian and Russian monarchs would do in the next several decades when the demands for reform reached those lands, and what the British themselves did in the Caribbean and in India, use force to put down the demands? The answer to this question comes from the virtuous circle. The economic and political changes that had already taken place in Britain made using force to repress these demands both unattractive for the elite and increasingly infeasible. As E.P. Thompson wrote, "When the struggles of 1790 to 1832 signaled that this equilibrium had changed, the rulers of England were faced with alarming alternatives. They could either dispense with the rule of law, dismantle their elaborate constitutional structures, countermand their own rhetoric and rule by force, or they could submit to their own rules and surrender their hegemony. They took halting steps in the first direction, but in the end, rather than shatter their own self-image and repudiate 150 years of constitutional legality, they surrendered to the law." Put differently, the same forces that made the British elite not wish to tear down the edifice of the rule of law during the Black Act also made them shun repression and rule by force, which would again risk the stability of the entire system. If undermining the law in trying to implement the Black Act would have weakened the system that merchants, businessmen, and the gentry had built in the Glorious Revolution, setting up a repressive dictatorship in 1832 would have entirely undermined it. In fact, the organizers of the protests for parliamentary reform were well aware of the importance of the rule of law and its symbolism to the British political institutions during this period. They used its rhetoric to bring home this point. One of the first organizations seeking parliamentary reform was called the Hampden Club, after the member of Parliament who had first resisted Charles I over the ship money tax, a crucial event leading up to the first major uprising against Stuart absolutism, as we saw in Chapter 7. There was also dynamic positive feedback between inclusive economic and political institutions, making such a course of action attractive. inclusive economic institutions led to the development of inclusive markets, inducing a more efficient allocation of resources, greater encouragement to acquire education and skills, and further innovations in technology. All of these forces